Welcome to Social Europe Podcast. Social Europe is a digital media publisher that publishes on politics, the economy, and employment and labor. You can find us on www.socialeurope.eu, where we publish new content 5 times a week from Monday to Friday. My name is Henning Meyer, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Social Europe Podcast. In the last episode, I promised that you will also get to listen to my thoughts about the digital revolution and what it means for work and society at large. And here we are. Today's episode is a recording of a talk that I delivered last week in Rome, incorporating not just what the digital revolution means for work and society, but also how social democracy should respond to it. The talk was entitled The Good Society 2.0, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, and thank you very much to the IBET Stiftung for inviting me again. It's always a pleasure to come back here to Rome and discuss the fortunes of social democracy and how it fits into wider sort of social and economic trends. Today, I would like to put to you the concept of what I would call Good Society 2.0. And let me elaborate a bit on this, because I think the work we have been doing over recent years in the framework of the Good Society project, I think we'll have to amend it to a new version to incorporate, I think, a new meta trend, as I would call it, that is emerging. It's going to change societies as we know them very significantly. So just as a reminder to start off, the Good Society 1.0, I mean, I think we were quite good in analyzing the problems, but I think it's fair to say that social democracy remains in a situation where it needs to renew itself, and it needs to renew itself in very turbulent times. We've heard already quite a bit about the third wave, which was the last sort of distinct phase of social democracy that you could easily identify. And as a result of this, I'm not going into more detail about this, but let me just point to two sort of consequences of the third wave that I think we still have to deal with today. The first one is that it was often claimed, and I think there's a lot of to it, that social democracy lost identity, authenticity, and trust as a result of these reforms. So what is distinctive about social democracy if it's basically reflecting an approximation to what we might want to call the neoliberal mainstream? So that is a question that has remained largely unanswered in recent years. And I would say the second part is about political style. Something that I've called in the past the problem of transactional politics versus transformational politics. Because the third wave was really born as an electoral strategy to get social democrats elected again. And as a result, the policy formation became very transactional in the sense that a lot of policy formation was done on the basis of opinion polls and focus groups rather than on the basis of an idea of a political project or of a society that would be on a normative basis better in the eyes of social democrats and develop policies on the way to get there. So we've become incredibly transactional, which has also led in terms of campaigning to the usage of methods that are now becoming really boring and outdated, like repeating the same sentences again, that some opinion poll told you voters might or might not respond to. This has created a fundamental problem. Also, against the backdrop of ever more diversified societies, being transactional means trying to design policies according to the perceived needs of smaller and smaller groups. So you eventually run into a dead end. And I think one of the fundamental insights of the Good Society 1.0, if you wish so, was that we need to reformulate a transformative political project on the basis of social democratic basic values that turns this relationship around, because you need to create an identity, a project that creates broader social buy-in in order to generate these electoral alliances that you need for gaining office, but at the same time actually when you are in office, because it's not an end in itself, it's a means towards an end, right? Enable policies and a policy agenda that actually improves the lives of people and moves society onwards towards something. So they need to move away more from this transactional mode of politics, more into a more transformational mode of politics, I think was one of the key insights of the Good Society project so far. So what is the basis of this? Well, it can only be the social democratic basic values. And these are freedom, justice, and social solidarity. And these form a basic political compass. So we called this the Good Society, just to recapitulate, not because we think we can ever reach it, but we want to devise a political compass that gives you a sense of direction. And the terms good and society are not a coincidence. We use the term good to show that it is not any kind of society, but it is a normative society. It's a society that is based on norms, and in which the norms are the social democratic basic values. And we focus on society to make clear that in the balance between the three basic dimensions of public life, which is state, markets, and civil society, we are not overburdening the one at the expense of the other. If you want, so market fundamentalism is trying to fix everything using the market. Communism is trying to fix everything using the state. And quite paradoxically, some ideas such as the big society were even trying to fix a lot of things using civil society only, for which it might or might not be designed to. So basically, the social democratic insight is that we need to combine the strength of all three of them and bring them into a mutually beneficial relationship and try to fade out the weaknesses of each individual dimension. And I think this remains the case. The basic driver, or the sort of the meta trend against which the Good Society 1.0 was developed, was basically problems in political economy. That became very apparent, obviously, in the wake of the economic and financial crisis of 2008, and as a consequence, produced issues such as runaway inequality and so on and so forth. I might add, these problems are largely unresolved, so I think we understand more about them. We see the consequences, and we see the consequences actually worsening, but I think in terms of fundamental reform, there hasn't been much done yet. So this job of addressing shortcomings of political economy remains unresolved. But I think it is very important to be sort of proactive and future looking, because there is a second meta trend on the horizon, which is gonna, or at least has the potential to change everything yet again, which is the digital revolution. And this is what I would like to sort of focus on in the rest of my talk, how the digital revolution impacts on work, how it impacts on the fundamental social democratic values, and what it means in terms of policy. And when I say digital revolution, I mean all sorts of technological advancements. It's a shorthand. It's not just computing power, right? So it's a shorthand for all sort of technological progress that is impacting our economies and our social lives. And why is this digital revolution so important, I think, for social democracy? Well, first of all, as I will try to explain, it directly impacts on pretty much all dimensions of the social democratic basic values. And second of all, the first sort of socio-economic realm where we can already see the impact of it is the world of work. And the world of work has always had a very specific position and very special position in social democracy as part of the labor movement. So I think these are the two fundamental reasons why we will have to be proactive about the digital revolution and what it means for social democratic politics. So let me just start with a few remarks about technology and what it means for work. I've been doing quite a lot of work on this in the last year. And I think the first thing is to understand what innovation is and how it works. Innovation is basically not reinventing the wheel all over again. Innovation happens, for the most part, if existing technologies are recombined to form something new. And the reason why a lot of researchers believe that we're at the cusp of an exponential growth in innovation is that because some of the core technologies are now reaching a maturity level where exponentially more new combinations become possible. And the core technologies are processing power, networking, decentralized production processes such as 3D printing, but also new materials such as graphene and things like that. So innovation is driven by the recombination of technologies, and a lot of these core technologies have reached a maturity where a lot more of these recombinations become possible. You can see that we might well be at the beginning of an innovation wave. And it will also lead, in terms of industry, to the mixing of industries. If Apple is now thinking about building a car, you suddenly have companies competing in a marketplace that used to be completely distinct. It used to be that, you know, German car makers built cars and Apple did computers. But these kind of industry boundaries are breaking up. Yeah, so you can also see how industries are actually merge into each other, and players coming from different positions but meet in completely new markets. This is also one of the key features. But if that is the case, if that is the driver of innovation, I think it's important to understand that there are, as far as I can see, four filters that prevent this innovation drive to impact directly onto the labor market. The first one is a social filter. So think Uber and taxi drivers, right? You will have some sort of existing groups that resist this change for one reason or the other, and as a result might slow down the adoption of certain technologies in certain markets. So the first one is the social filter. The second one is an ethical filter. If you think about genetic engineering, not everything that is possible is actually ethical and thus can or will be done. So there is an ethical filter to this as well. There is also a legal filter. From a technology point of view, self-driving cars are not a problem anymore, but you still don't see them on the streets. Why? Well, because the legal framework is simply not there, and the insurance framework to actually have these technologies doing their job. So there is a legal filter as well. And I think economically speaking, very importantly, there is a productivity filter as well. And that was a discussion I had with David Alter from MIT recently. And this is very important to understand, because technology is not always the productivity enabler that we see. I'll give you two examples for that. If you think about your computers and Microsoft Word you run on your computers now, your computers are now 1,000 times as faster than the computers were in the 1980s. But you're not 1,000 times more productive. Why? Because the productivity bottleneck was simply not Word or the processing power of the computer, but you as the author or as the person using Word is the productivity bottleneck. So you have diminishing marginal returns on the use of some of these technologies. And the second example I liked very much was that David told me was when one consultant of a leading consultancy firm, I can't remember which one it was presenting a washing machine to a group of academics and said, well, look at this washing machine. It's got more processing power than the whole Apollo moon program. And the idea was that everybody should be in awe and say, oh, that's a great thing. And he said, well, I as an economist just thought diminishing marginal returns, because the washing machine is not going to go to the moon anytime soon. It's still only going to wash your laundry. So diminishing marginal returns in that context, that means you actually put processing power into devices where it actually adds marginally to productivity. So from a usage point of view, you might be able to start and stop it from your smartphone or from your watch, but fundamentally it still only does wash the laundry. So these are the four filters that I think we have to be aware of that sort of filter the way in which these new innovations actually do impact our daily lives. And when it comes to work, there are three trends that we have to be aware of, which is substitution, augmentation, and innovation, new jobs. For substitutions, it is very clear that some jobs are going to be substituted. If the first machine age was about machines replacing manual labor, the second one that we now live through is about cognitive work being more and more replaceable by the technologies that I've already mentioned. So in terms of substitutions, there are two questions. The first one is, which jobs will disappear completely as a result of automation? And the second one is, which jobs will be split up into tasks that are then crowdsourced from all sorts of people. So that's what some people call the gig economy, where it is not a full-time job anymore, but you basically have, so I need a transcript of this audio file, for instance. It's not my secretary doing it anymore, but it's one specific task that I crowdsource to somebody anywhere in the world who could do that. It's not the same as, you know, jobs disappearing completely, but it's about jobs being broken up into different tasks. augmentation is basically how will these technologies change the relationship between what the machine does and what a human being does. So you might very well have the case where jobs are not disappearing, but the job description changes, sometimes even beyond recognition, in terms of what you do. So think of supermarkets, for instance. You used to have 10 cashiers, now you have 10 robots and one person supervising the cashier. So that job description has changed. So you now need to have a basic understanding of how to maintain and operate these machines rather than sort of just collecting the groceries. So the question is, how will in different work fields this relationship change, and how will the job change as a result? And the second question is, how will that impact onto the quantity of jobs needed? Because in this particular example, you used to have 10 cashiers and 10 people sitting at the cashiers, and now you have 10 robots and one person supervising it. So the need is, in that case, cut down to 1/10 of what you used to have. And then the question is, of course, there will be new jobs created in certain sectors, but here we really have a question of how quickly will these jobs be created, what quantity of jobs will we have, and what will be the quality of these jobs, and where will these jobs be created. And we have already quite disturbing trends that we see downward social mobility because the jobs are not being created at the same qualitative level and the same quantity. Another point that David also mentioned in our conversation was that what in the US used to be seen as typical teen jobs, burger flipping and things like that, are no longer done by teenagers, but by adults, you know, who were replaced somewhere and moved downwards. The whole idea, and when I discussed this with Evan Davies at Newsnight last year, was, yeah, well, we didn't see all these nail bars everywhere. So this whole sort of low-skilled personalized service sector is growing as a result, because that is a thing you cannot easily automate. So there is a question about social mobility downwards, velocity of change, and how these jobs will be created, in what quality and where. So if you have these three basic elements, substitution, augmentation, and new jobs, what is the balance between the three? And the honest answer is nobody knows. We have different studies that go from, you know, colleagues at Oxford saying 47% of the US labor market would be affected. Yesterday there was an article in The Guardian of the Bank of England using exactly the same method and saying that would put 15 million jobs in the UK at risk. We have a study by ZEW from Germany that the German Labour Ministry actually gave the contract for. They say, okay, it's going to be about 12% in Germany. The honest answer is, because it's all modelled, nobody really knows. But from a political point of view, I'd say we need to be prepared. If even some, and even 12%, which is at the lower end, it's a huge number, right? If 12% of jobs disappear, and you don't know how quickly they might disappear, you better be prepared, because otherwise you will have fundamental problems. So that's for me the reason why I think this sort of digital revolution is the second big meta trend coming into play that social democracy really has to tackle. And it's at the moment still we have the political economy issues that are linked to globalization that we discussed earlier as the main driver, but these might well be overtaken in due course by this kind of digital revolution that will, and it's very likely to cause some political problems. So what does this mean for social democratic values? Well, in the realm of freedom, I think this is where the digital revolution is best understood so far. It does provide new sorts of freedom because, you know, everybody has access to information now, it connects people, and it has a clear participatory element. I mean, one element, for instance, of the gig economy is that disabled people could, for instance, now participate in an economy where they used to be excluded from. So there are some positive elements of this as well. But at the same time, it's become very clear that big data erodes privacy and it centralizes powers in big companies and security services, right? So you will have to deal with this as well. And the fundamental philosophical insight, I think, is that if a person becomes a fully transparent person, that person becomes unfree. So society needs confidential spaces, and we need to create the framework where you have data autonomy for people, where people can basically actually oversee the personal data that is being collected on them and know and can decide upon where this data is being used. When it comes to justice, I think the inequality element that, you know, derives from the political economy argument earlier comes into play very, very heavily here. Because if we see significant effects on the labor market, this will increase inequalities quite significantly. And this increase of inequality will happen against the backdrop of inequality already back at the highest levels ever since the Belle Epoque or the late 19th century, as Thomas Piketty has shown. So we're not starting from low levels, but you know, we might be at the beginning of a process that from very high levels already might accelerate inequality further. I've already mentioned the problem with potentially downward social mobility. At the moment, if you know, this is a new capitalist phase as well, and it creates predominantly winner-takes-all markets. If you look, for instance, at the acquisition of WhatsApp by Facebook a few years ago, I can't remember how many billions they paid for this company, but I think Robert Reich made the point at the time, I think very eloquently, that a company that with that kind of valuation used to employ tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. WhatsApp, I think, employed about 55 people by the time they were taken over for billions and billions. So you could see that a small group of people benefited vastly from it. And at the same time, it shows you what the scale is. These 55 people could serve millions of customers using their app, right? So you see the scalability of these things, but you can see how this kind of digital capitalism creates winner-takes-all markets that, again, on top of social mobility issues, might well increase inequality. So from a policy point of view, there's a simple conclusion. At the bottom of it, the dividend from the digital revolution needs to be distributed society-wide. So the digital revolution is primarily a question of distribution and how the primary as well as secondary distribution system deals with it. So I think that's very important to understand in terms of inequality. And that goes back now into the area of solidarity. We've already mentioned that economies not work only on supply, but economies need demand. And the digital revolution is primarily a supply-side revolution, as, for instance, the WhatsApp example shows, where a group of 50 or 60 people can build a technology that serves millions of customers. But somebody needs to be able to buy that stuff, right? To put it bluntly. And if you see, and we already see some macroeconomic dysfunctions as a result of that, again, perpetuated by the problems of inequality we already had. And if you look at the potential solutions to that are being presented in places such as Silicon Valley, I think we as social democrats need to be very wary. Because what is the most often or most frequently heard solution to this is a libertarian version of the basic income. Basically, the argument is we need to give everybody enough money so they're going to be able to buy our products, but that's about it. There are very significant problems attached to this. First of all, I think a basic income reduces work to income, which I don't think is a reduction that is permissible. Obviously, we know that work is a sort of self-esteem, of social interaction, and so on and so forth. Of course, income is an important part of work, but it's not the only part of work. So this reduction, I don't think, is permissible. The second one is, I think, this is a very poor use of public money, of scarce public resources, because it needs to be a universal basic income paid to everybody, also the not needy. And the argument goes that this is going to be recuperated via the tax system. Well, if you see how many holes there are, especially at the upper end of the tax system, I think this is much easier said than done. So I would expect significant leakages in the tax system, where a lot of public money goes to the people who are not needy and who don't need their money. So I therefore think there are better ways of using scarce public resources. And the third criticism would be, I don't think it is implementable in the framework of the European Union. So far, there's very little evidence of social benefits being a pull factor for migration within the European Union. But imagine Germany or France introducing a universal basic income of, say, 1,500 euros a month for everybody. Under the non-discrimination rule, you know, that would apply to everybody. And that, I mean, you could easily see that would create a pull factor where it was basically money for free for everybody who has a legal right to be resident in Germany. So within the framework of the European Union, I see a big problem in this. And where I think social democrats need to become very, very careful is that if you ask these people who propose this basic income about how to fund it, they say, well, we'll have to take it from elsewhere. Basically, what they mean is they want to cut down public services and individualize public services. What it basically means This is the axe at the fundamental dogma of European social democracy, which is welfare state. Welfare state in the sense of a universal insurance against the big life risks of unemployment, ill health, old age, and so on and so forth. Because the argument goes, so we'll take the money out of the social security system, we give it to people individually, and then they can buy their private health insurance, they can do their private pension fund, and these sort of things. So when some of these tech people say, we want to change the world, it's sometimes not just marketing, right? If you look at these sort of proposals, this is a fundamentally different vision of society, and it's fundamentally different from the social democratic vision based on universal welfare that we have developed over the course of the last century. So I think social democracy need to be very careful about this, and that creates the need to develop a social democratic version of the digital society. There are undoubtedly many benefits that can be leveraged from the digital revolution, and we should make sure we get all the benefits, distribute the benefits as widely throughout society as possible. But at the same time, I can't see any direct linkage, or why should the people presenting the technology or providing the technology also supply the social model for us, or their idea of society. I think that might not be their job. So we have to be wary about this. So we have to come up with a social democratic alternative to this. And towards the end of this, I would like to suggest four policy areas where I think we will have to think about in the future before I conclude. Well, the first is obviously reform of the educational system. If new jobs require skills that we might not even know, and augmentation means existing job descriptions change beyond recognition, recalibrating what our education system does, I think it's utterly important. Much of what I can see, especially in primary education, still seems to be geared towards an age where access to information was not a given. So that means you need to learn quite a few things by heart. But today, access to information is a given. So access to this information is no longer the problem. The problem is that you need to be able to turn this information into knowledge. And that needs creative and analytical capabilities, that have to have, in my view, a much higher priority in the education system than so far. The second one is basically, if we can produce so much more with so much less labor, we are back to the Keynesian problem of the 1930s. So we have to think about redistributing the remaining work that is there to be done. So there are all sorts of reasons why we haven't reduced working hours yet, but the basic Keynesian arguments of, why the economic prospects of our grandchildren, that, productivity will be runaway productivity, and as a result, we satisfied most of our needs, and therefore we will opt for more leisure time and less work. That question will be asked again. And there is an opportunity, and again, it's a distribution issue. If you leverage the dividend that is coming out of the digital revolution properly, we can have very good lives with fewer working hours. And, that might not be a bad thing. The third element, I think, is very important as well. If you accept the Piketty relationship, that there is a structural advantage of capital vis-a-vis labor, we will have to rethink capital ownership as well, and on at least two levels. Another podcast discussion I did with Richard Freeman from Harvard actually made the point, and Richard has been vocal on this for quite some time, is that workers should own more of their own companies. So on an individual level, we have to maybe rethink or come back with the topic of labor or workers' ownership of capital itself. On a macroeconomic level, I think based on ideas that were presented in Berlin last year by an Italian economist at the Free University of Berlin, Giacomo Corneo, I think having investment vehicles such as sovereign wealth funds would be a good idea to re-socialize dividends from capital. So you can obviously do more in the secondary distribution with the tax system to soften the blow of these inequalities. But the marginal tax rate would go towards 100% if you want to have it all via the tax system. So you can accompany this by sort of re-socializing the proceeds of capital, for instance, via a sovereign wealth fund, where the dividend goes not to the capitalist, but the capitalist is actually the state. And the state can then use this income to spend on whatever the democratic process decides on what it should be spent on. So it's individual capital ownership within companies, but also public ownership on a macroeconomic scale. I think this is something that we should rethink. And sort of my five pennies in this discussion has been why I already lined out why I don't like the basic income, but what could be the alternative? Well, I think thinking about a job guarantee is much more plausible in this context than about the basic income, because it covers, at least in theory, the problems that are outlined about the basic income. First of all, it doesn't reduce work to income. It preserves the social elements of work as well. Because people have to come forward to claim such a job, there are no leakages. So you wouldn't spend money on people that don't need that money. And third of all, it is already partially on a policy agenda. If you look at the European Youth Guarantee, it is basically the similar idea that there is a guarantee. It's not being implemented very well at the moment, but at least it's already there on the agenda. And we are learning lessons now, and we could maybe take the lessons from there and move it onto the wider labor market. There are models there already, Bill Mitchell, buffer stock employment model, and these sort of things. I think these are the things that we should look at. So, because it would address these three shortcomings of the basic income that I suggested, but it would also create a new public policy tool. Because the one thing I haven't mentioned so far is that not all areas of our lives will be readily automatable. Jobs based on social capital and based on human interaction will not be very easily automatable. And against the backdrop of aging societies and especially shortages in care, if you have a public job guarantee, it would give you a public policy tool to create incentives for jobs in these areas where we are underserved at the moment. So you could actually address the broader demographic issue of aging societies and higher and higher percentages of dementia and so on and so forth with this tool. It gives you an additional tool on top of the economic function, on top of the work function, gives you a public policy tool to potentially address some other of the some other social policy issues as well. So as this is sort of very early days, but I think this is basically the framework in which we have to continue to work on good society 1.0 issues effectively, which is basically political economy issues linked to globalization and resulting problems such as inequality. But we really have to incorporate the nascent digital revolution into our thinking. And because of the potential problems, we need to have solutions if and when they come about. So social democracy was founded during the first industrial revolution to actually soften the blow of this. This could almost be something like a refoundation moment for social democracy if the second machine age is bringing about these problems that I've just outlined. We've only started this discussion, but I think it's a very important one to be had, and I think we have to come to grips with these issues, and I'm looking forward to discussing this with you. Thank you.
You've just listened to an episode of Social Europe Podcast. If you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe on iTunes or on Stitcher, or sign up to our newsletter on www.socialeurope.eu.